Hi, this is Tony Bruschi, host of The Grave Talks, the show you're about to listen to. We're very excited about getting this show off the ground, but we can only do it with your support. And that means letting other folks know that this show is out there and exists. And in exchange for doing that, I'm going to give you a special gift. Okay, so what I need you to do is go to the show's podcast page on whatever platform it is you're listening to. So look up The Grave Talks on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, whatever it may be that you download podcasts on, and leave us a positive review, some stars, some nice words. That would be tremendously helpful. And press subscribe. Once you do that, email me, okay, Tony, T-O-N-Y, at thegravetalks.com. When you do that, I will send you an exclusive extra episode of The Grave Talks, one that has not yet been released publicly. You will get it and get to experience it before anybody else. That's in exchange for your support of the show and being one of the first people on board, letting other people know that we exist. Okay? That is in exchange for your 5 minutes of leaving a positive review and subscribing. So do that. Thank you so much. Let's get this thing off to a great start. And I can't wait for what the future holds of The Grave Talks. Thank you for your support. Today on The Grave Talks, the Malvern Manor. The Malvern Manor in Iowa has a very storied history. Originally built in the 1880s as a cottage hotel and the town's first hotel, many guests spent many nights there. The hotel, originally about 10,000 square feet, went through a handful of owners and eventually was converted from a hotel into a nursing facility and later a group home, where many questionable activities occurred under its watch. Long after the building had fallen into disrepair, rumors of strange happenings began to emerge from the Malvern Manor. Today, we're going to be talking with Josh Hurd, the current owner of the Malvern Manor, and what exactly is going on there, or what occurred there at one time that's still occurring to this day.
From everything that we can tell, it was the fourth or fifth building that was actually constructed in this town. So I'm just guessing here. But I would say that, you know, it was definitely one of the first structures that was put up in this town. Right. So we do know that its primary function at that time was a hotel. Now, just a couple hundred yards out the front door used to sit a rail line. So this would have been, you know, primarily servicing the railroad. People that were, you know, coming in or out of town or on business or what have you. But primarily it was servicing them and these people. So we do know that it was, you know, it got to be more and more as far as like popularity. This was, you know, the place to be in this area. So it was kind of the central hub of the community for quite some time. It's kind of hard to imagine, you know, life back then, but obviously, you know, you still had the horse-drawn carriages. You still had doctors that would come in and out of your community and stay for 2 weeks, to a month in some cases, and they would see everybody. Now, this building, we do know, was also used for that purpose. Like, these doctors would come here and set up shop, so to speak, and people would just line up. They would come and, you know, get checked out for this, that, and the other thing. It was just kind of interesting. You know, it's not like nowadays where you could just go schedule an appointment and just go show up or whatever. This was something that was planned out as far as, you know, going to see a healthcare professional. So very interesting stuff for sure.
The question is, what sort of medical practices were taking place behind the walls of the Malvern Manor?
Yeah, no, I don't think any surgeries or anything like that. I will say that there were some that seemed, you know, fairly what we would call legit, you know, nowadays. some people that would, you know, just basically give you a checkup here or there. Now, there are other doctors that I can see on record here that were more or less what we would call like snake oil salesmen. Dr. McGillicuddy's like cure-all type stuff, you know. Very interesting, the assorted cast of characters that came in and out of this place.
Let's talk about that cast of characters beyond the medical field. Who else would have been frequenting the manor in its hotel days?
You know, ladies that claim to be like psychic mediums that would come through the building as well, give readings. I don't believe it was ever like a gallery type reading like we would see today, but I do believe it was more like a one-on-one type of basis. But yeah, fairly interesting stuff.
At one point, though, the good times came to an end, and the Malvern Manor ceased operation as a hotel. Why exactly did that occur?
You know, as far as that, yeah, you have more and more people, you know, getting their own automobiles and things of that nature. Less and less rail travel. Kind of saw the decline in business. And you know, this is where, you know, I mean, the place still operated, as a hotel all the way up until the 1950s. So, you know, we're talking the late 1800s all the way up till the 1950s. This place was still a hotel. Now I will say it changed hands quite often. Almost like people were losing it in a poker game. Like, it was quite frequently that they were coming across all this stuff and switching ownership. So,
are there any records as to what happened with the last set of owners when it was a hotel?
They just basically went off. They went off their own separate ways. Now, this is where it becomes like fascinating stuff for me. Like looking through all this history and trying to really like put my finger on it as much as possible. We see the owners kind of shuffle off and the building kind of sits vacant for a while. Now, we do know that in the 50s, it becomes what we would consider to be like a nursing home. So a lot of work started on this building, kind of updating it and things of that nature. They added this little section of house, which if you're, you know, standing outside of the house, you can see this section of building that looks like it just doesn't belong, like, at all. And that is essentially what we just call the nursing home wing of the house. So, like, back there, for example, you will find wider door frames, a lot of laminate type of flooring, kind of suggesting a more medical atmosphere. Walking back there.
Let's talk about its next incarnation as a nursing facility. What was life like at the Malvern Manor 2.0, the nursing home?
Pretty good, actually. You know, Malvern is kind of just a go-with-the-flow type of town anyway, a very small town in Iowa, but they're very supportive, that is for sure, especially when it comes to their community. So this coming in was a good thing. They were seeing this as a positive thing, especially to, you know, kind of assist the elderly as much as possible. Sadly, like looking back at everything, we can see that, from 1956 is about when this nursing home facility began, but it didn't last very long because we know in the 1970s, the state of Iowa comes in and they say, hey, your hallways aren't wide enough to really support transporting beds and things of that nature. So ultimately, it was closed down for that purpose. There was a lady that was working here at that time while it was still functioning as a nursing home. Now, her name was Geraldine. She kind of took over the reins. It's like, well, if it cannot be a nursing home, she ended up, you know, getting the building for herself. But she turned it into, you know, what we would consider kind of like a group home for mentally handicapped people and things of that nature. Now, I will say this, like Geraldine loved this place so much that in the back of this building where I usually have people park underneath the carport, you'll see a trailer house that sits just a few feet off of the actual structure itself. That was Geraldine's home. She loved this place like that much, and the clientele that much. And she put her home right up next to this place so she could be here, you know, whenever somebody needed her. If that tells you anything about her character, you know, it's pretty impressive stuff. Now, we do know that she was quite up there in age when this place was a group home. Now, the types of people that they serviced here while it was a group home was, I mean, anything from people with Down syndrome, people with alcoholism, things that we see every day, to very exotic cases of multiple personalities, or DID, I believe is what they call it nowadays. Even schizophrenia, even murderers were housed here. This is a very odd cast of characters coexisting under the same roof, especially by today's standards. Now, ultimately, like I said, Geraldine was quite up there in age, and I believe she was 87 years old when the state of Iowa basically forced her to retire. Now, with that, we're talking mid to late 90s. Now, we know that another gentleman took over the building. He was not very well liked around the area, especially by the people who lived here, people that worked here. He did a lot of shady business practices. Ultimately, it kind of comes out in the wash that he was stealing money from these clients that lived here. He was verbally abusive, sometimes physically abusive, a lot of nasty stuff. He's obviously in jail now. But yeah, ultimately this place did close down, and it wasn't until 2005 that the place ultimately closed down due to neglect, abuse. I mean, it's a very long laundry list of reasons why.
One of the most troubling things we hear are stories of neglect and abuse of those who are unable to defend themselves. Unfortunately, that tends to be an all too common chapter in the book of a haunted facility. Can you tell us any more about what occurred within the walls of this building?
You know, there was one, there's one instance that was told to us, like, you know, when we acquired the building for ourselves over here, getting a solid lock on this history was the most important to me. It's very important that I don't present people with BS. We had some of the former nursing staff walk us through the building, kind of tell us all their old war stories, so to speak. And, you know, there was one story that they told us in particular that had to do with the guy that owned it at the time, literally, like, hitting and kicking a gentleman from his office, which is located downstairs, all the way up the steps and into this guy's room. Now, what's interesting about this is you can still see evidence of a struggle on the walls themselves. There are strange markings on the wall. They look like stains. We ended up hiring a private detective to dig up some of this history, because let's face it, small town Iowa, a lot of this stuff kind of gets swept under the rug. So he does his investigation. I told him to spend a little extra time upstairs in that hallway in particular. And he was able to conduct three separate tests on three separate sections of this hallway, specifically surrounding those markings. What he found was each time those markings did come back positive for human blood. So that is what we're observing physically. And he was also able to tell us that whoever this person was the same person. Now, that's where I told him to stop his investigation. Again, I don't need to know specifics. My job isn't to step on the toes of anybody, especially the family members who are still very much in this area. I don't want to do that. The questions I still have pertaining to those markings are questions that I'm never going to have answers to. Like, how did it actually get there and why it was never cleaned up? Especially in a facility like this, you would never see that. So why was it just left? Why was it just left there? Very interesting, very disturbing to look at some of these markings. I will say that it's very odd, but that was one of the bigger stories that they did tell us, kind of going through the building.
Probably for the better, in 2005, the facility is shut down. What then occurred with the building after those years?
It sits. It does literally nothing. Now, there was a gentleman who we ended up buying the property from. He took over the property. He had many different ideas of what to do with the building itself. Nothing really ever came to fruition for him. He thought about reopening it up as a hotel again, maybe a bed and breakfast of sorts. But nothing, I mean, the amount of work that really had to go into this place, it just really wasn't worth it. I mean, it is a 10,000-foot structure. And I can't even imagine the amount of money that would have to go into that. So he did live here for roughly 6 months or so. Now, after that, he ended up buying the house just next door. He said there was a lot of odd things that were happening, things that he couldn't necessarily put his finger on. He's not necessarily a believer in the paranormal, but there were a few times that he did get creeped out, so to speak, and, you know, would have to, you know, leave the building, take himself out of the equation because he was freaked out.
Josh, let me ask you, what drew you to the building? What was your initial involvement with the Malvern Manor?
Dude, it was the craziest set of accidents kind of set in motion for me acquiring this building. So it was my first documentary film that I ever made. It was actually night one of filming, and we were just across the street here in Malvern, Iowa, at this really cool place called the Classic Cafe. They have their own slew of paranormal happenings over there, and they were nice enough to allow us to film like a ghost hunt, so to speak. And I didn't realize there's a bar that's attached to the Classic Cafe, so with noise contamination and everything like that, like, it was just not going to happen. I went outside, kind of trying to come up with a plan B, and I ended up meeting that gentleman that I just got done talking about that owned this building. And he kind of went through the history with me a little bit. It used to be this, it used to be that. And really, you know, was really telling me about some of the spooky things that were going on, things that he was seeing, things that he was hearing. I'm like, where is this place located? Because it sounds like a dream come true. And he's like, oh, it's just right across the street. Now, he was nice enough to let us in that night, and we experienced more in the first 2 hours of investigating than we had in the last 2 years. So it's kind of interesting, because if you watch my first documentary film, it is literally the first 10 minutes of that movie is us finding this place that we now call Malvern Manor. It's kind of weird, like how everything kind of falls into place, so to speak. But I was so impressed with this building. I knew that he wanted to sell it at some point, and he was leaving the area to switch jobs, and we just hopped on it, you know?
Let's hear about your first experiences inside the Malvern Manor.
Right. So we were hearing a lot. And that's one thing that I will say is with this place, it's very audible and it's very physical. So we were hearing a lot of what sounded like running, what sounded like footsteps, and little like pitter patters of feet. which is enough to, you know, freak anybody out. But at the same time, we were, you know, hearing our names being called. We were getting tugs on our clothing. We were feeling like pokes and stuff in our backs and in our stomachs. Very odd stuff. And so that really got my head, you know, turning. And then obviously getting into the building more and more and investigating more, like, we were able to experience a slew of activity, including what we call, like, you know, the shadow man and all of that.
The first time you're in the building and experiencing paranormal activity, is the first thing that goes through your mind also that, or are you trying to deduct and reason that maybe there's something else going on here? Gas, electricity, what are you thinking?
Initially going through my mind was, is this some kind of a higher level of EMF creating something in our minds? Are we hallucinating? Creating, I guess, what some people consider to be like a fear cage, right? Because we had no idea. We knew the place had electricity. How good that electricity was, we had no idea. So it's quite feasible that there'd be some bad wiring somewhere, probably sending off high amounts of EMF. That was where my mind initially went. Now, I do know at that time there was gas. However, it was just run to one little, it looks like a wood-burning type stove. It's one of those fake wood burning stoves, but that's the only place that the gas was ran. So it was interesting going through all of this stuff and experiencing this with my friends. But yeah, so I tried to, you know, debunk as much as possible, and especially then over the next few months, coming in and out of this place all the time, really taking some good readings and all of that. The problem was, like, we did find a couple spots that had higher amounts of EMF. Sadly, those spots weren't anywhere that we were experiencing anything like that. I mean, it wasn't even on the same floor. So, very interesting.
Soon after acquiring the building, Josh discovered that some of the residents, maybe some is too light of a term, many of the residents seemed to still be there, although they had passed their physical living bodies. One of them is named Gracie.
Right. Now, that was the first big one that we really came across, because going into this room, now, that's another thing that I always tell people, you know, since that night of filming that we first stumbled into this building, we haven't touched anything. We've kept the building exactly the way we found it, which I feel kind of adds to the integrity of the place from an investigative standpoint anyway. But it was funny because doing EVPs and things of that nature, like EVP sessions specifically in that room, we were getting the name Gracie, consistently getting this name. And we're like, okay. Now, it wasn't then until later and acquiring the building for ourselves that we had that nursing staff walk through the building. Now, me being me, I didn't want to give them any information whatsoever of things that we had collected. So I was like, so whose room was this? If you can remember, you know, whose room? And they said that name. I'm like, get out of here. You know, so it was like one of those really cool things where history and evidence kind of shake hands there, so to speak. Now, they ended up telling us a lot about her background and how she was multiple personalities, schizophrenic. Many times they would hear like male voices coming from Gracie's room, which the nursing station itself only sat maybe 15 feet away. So very much an earshot. But hearing a male's voice coming from a female's bedroom, that's some cause for concern. And so they would have to obviously check that out. But when they went in there, they would find it was only her. She could shift and manipulate her voice to make it sound male. Another interesting thing that they told us was one evening, there was three nurses that sat with her for a single hour, and within the hour documented 13 separate personalities, which is medically unheard of. The different medical professionals that we've talked to specifically about DID and that disease itself, they said, no, you're doing really fine if you have, you know, two or three personalities. 13 is almost unheard of, honestly. It also kind of makes you then wonder if this small town facility was the proper fit for her. It's kind of interesting, but we do know that she seems to be,
with a story like that, it makes you wonder if maybe there was something more going on with her than just that disease.
And exactly. Many times, she was quoted as saying, the devil's coming to get me. The devil's coming to get me. And this freaked out the staff. Obviously, you hear somebody saying things like this. It does. It kind of begs the question, you know, is there something else going on that we're not exactly privy to?
What have your experiences been in the building with her today, now that she's passed, but still seeming to be there?
One thing that's very interesting that we've kind of started to see this trend is she seems to be drawn more to male investigators for whatever reason that may be. Guys, especially if gentlemen are sitting in her wheelchair, if they are lying on her bed, which again, we openly invite people to do this, they will feel pressure on their legs, tugging on their pants, and sometimes it feels like she is trying to grab your private parts. The only time that we've got like her voice or anything like that has just been specifically on recordings. Now I will say, sometimes after having a really good like EVP session, or you're experiencing a lot within that room. Like personally, I've gone to then leave the room, and you hear like two very loud bangs on what almost sound like the door frame itself. Almost like, don't leave. You know, we're not done here. Come back. It's I don't know. It's almost sad to me. Like she's just lonely, you know.
Another very sad story of a resident at the Milburn Manor is of a woman who began to obsessively believe that her husband no longer found her attractive. Trying to get her help, he admitted her to the hospital to try and correct this belief.
Yeah, as far as we can tell, and everything that we've been told, is she was about in her mid-30s. Apparently, she was also very attractive, a very attractive woman. But yeah, like you said, she thought, my husband doesn't love me anymore. He doesn't find me attractive. And this became quite the obsession, to the point where he did admit her into this building, where then she would stand at the sink looking into the mirror in there and pluck the hair out of her head one by one. I mean, it's terrible. It's gut-wrenching, you know, to think of somebody doing that to themselves. And I'm sure that her husband never thought those thoughts, you know, about her, and loved her very much. And that's why he was trying to get her the proper care that she needed. It's terrible. There's also in that room, which is just room 7, we hear a lot of like a weird moaning type crying sound. We also smell this very, and it's very sporadic, the smell. It comes and it goes, but it almost smells like body odor, like somebody hasn't worn deodorant in a few days. And again, it's very sporadic, and it comes and it goes. The door itself to room 7 also will open and close. There was around Halloween of just last year, so not that long ago, really, we had a group of 45 people in this building, which is almost pushing it to the limit. But we were all back in what we call the nursing home wing back there, and 45 people witnessed this door open on command. It was really quite something to see.
I was beginning to wonder at first, would this be a conscious entity or a residual entity? From what you're telling me, it almost seems to lean more towards the conscious area. Would you agree?
It does seem to be more conscious in nature. Especially when you ask, you know, to open, and then you ask her to close, and she complies with that, and it happens. Sometimes the lights themselves in that room will turn on and off. Now, I know, obviously, now I know the building quite well, and I also know there's absolutely nothing wrong with that wiring. It's brand new. So that switch needs to be physically manipulated.
Not everything at the manor is friendly or kind or peaceful or just going about its daily routine. There appears to be some dark energy there as well.
It seems to be. You know, up in the attic itself is kind of an anomaly to us. We have not been able to been told ever what the attic was ever used for. Now, when you're up in the attic, I would suggest that the room itself had some form of purpose. There is paint and trim and, you know, baseboards, moldings, things like that. I would not, if it was just used for storage, I wouldn't finish a room that was just going to be used specifically for storage. Even an old chimney that sits up there has a paint job on it. Now, the chimney itself was knocked down because it was the cause of a fire, which there is still fire damage up there, which you can see. And we're actually currently working with the fire department to see if we can pinpoint an actual date when that fire happened. They have records that go back to the 30s, and so they've been doing some digging for us, which is always appreciated. But there is something up in that attic that does not enjoy the company of people. I usually say that people are good for 20 to 30 minutes before they will begin to feel disoriented, physically ill, nauseous in some way. And I usually tell people, and this is me personally as well, just walking down the stairs into the hallway, and it's usually that feeling will pass. That's usually enough to do it. We've had plenty of people toss their cookies, so to speak, up in the attic, which makes for a super fantastic day for me, like having to clean that stuff up. It's crazy up there. So whatever or whoever is up there not enjoy the company of people, he will tell you, sometimes quite audibly, to leave, get out, sometimes in not so nice terms. Basically do anything that he can to get you back down those stairs. Now, he'll also beg you for alcohol and cigarettes and things of that nature. Very addictive type of personality. Almost textbook.
How do these requests come about?
Yeah, usually it's just via EVPs. Sometimes even like a GeoBox or GeoPort or Spirit Box of some sort. And you hear these requests. Other times, quite audibly up there, you will hear what sounds like growling. And it's a very loud, unsettling type of sound. You'll hear scratching behind the walls. Now, it's interesting because you can see behind the walls. You can see there's like a crawl space area back there, and you can quite clearly see on either side of this room there's crawl spaces. And so me personally, first time I heard, you know, the growling and the scratching, I thought it was an animal. An old building, it's very feasible that an animal would be in here. So I've now personally been back in this crawl space area of the attic 6 separate times, looking for things that would suggest something is or was alive, whether that be carcass or droppings or anything. The only things that I have found up there are very personal items. Playing cards, tobacco pouches, keys, crushed up packs of cigarettes, beer cans, things of that nature, like very personal items, which I then take out of there and I place on display in our little office area over here.
Josh, take us to some of the other rooms that are at the Melvern Manor and some of the other guests or residents. I guess you're more of the guest there now that still occupy these halls.
There are a couple. So there is this lady that we call Susie. Now, everything that that former nursing staff was, you know, legally able to tell us about Susie is that she was a middle-aged patient, but mentally speaking, she was probably closer to around the age of 8, maybe 10 years of age. So we've, in her room, found a lot of coloring books, activity books, crayons, you know, things of that nature. It's really quite something. We always, you know, invite people to color in these books or write a note or whatever in these books. She seems to really enjoy interacting with people, so much so even she will manipulate pages in the books, which is quite something to see a page turn on its own. Very interesting stuff. Now, what's fascinating to me is the activity itself seems to be contained to that room. Many of the other, what I call like resident spirits here, are fairly transient and will follow you throughout this building and kind of mess with you all day or night. She stays put, and we're not quite sure why that is. However, EVPs and things of that nature that we've been collecting now just over the past couple months have suggested that something may be keeping her there. She doesn't want to leave that room. She's scared of something that's out just in that hallway there. So it kind of makes you wonder what's really going on. One of my personal favorites is who we call Hank or Henry. And I always say it kind of depends on the day and what he wants to be called. But I just call him Hank. Now he, from everything that everybody has told us, he was quite up there in age. However, he's also your very stereotypical grumpy old man. He would sit out on the front porch and throw rocks at kids and stuff. Like, he's just not really a nice guy at all. Now, another thing that we also know is he has a very big problem with females. For whatever reason that may be, a very big problem with females. Now, in Hank's room specifically, again, everything is how we found it. And in one of his dresser drawers, it was full of clothes. And so the clothes that we've been able to kind of deduce now is... The clothes seem to be kind of an antecedent for activity, meaning you mess with his clothes and he's going to get upset in some way, shape, or form. So I always invite ladies, if they want to elicit some kind of a response, to maybe try on an article of clothing or two, maybe make light of the fact that they are wearing his clothes. But even the simple act of taking those clothes and folding them up nicely and placing them nicely back in the drawer is enough to set him off. But a lot of vocal and physical activity goes on up there.
When you have former staff members returning to this building to take a tour or to see it, what is their reaction?
A few of them did... kind of get spooked out, for lack of a better term, I guess, while being here. They're just like, wow. I think they were just flooded with, you know, memories and emotions and just, I mean, that nostalgic feeling of being back here where they spent the majority of their life. And so I don't know if it was the spirits or if it was just an overwhelming feeling. Of being here.
What does the future hold for the Melvern Manor?
Honestly, at this point in time, I'd like to just keep the building doing exactly what it is doing. opening the doors to other paranormal investigators who want to come and experience this stuff for themselves. I always openly invite people to share either their evidence or their experiences. We have, you know, log books and things like that sitting out where people can write notes and different things of that nature. And I like to correlate evidence as much as possible to see, you know, trying to ultimately just put this crossword puzzle together. You know, it's not a cut and dry case like a lot of these haunted locations are, where it's like, oh, we know something tragic happened on this specific day, and that's probably the antecedent for activity. It's like up here, there are so many variables in play. For example, back in the nursing home wing, in the room that we call just room number two, room two is quite fascinating. You're standing like basically in the middle of the hallway, and you're looking down this very long hallway towards room two, and you see a very tall, black, humanoid figure appear from the room, and it will turn and then chase you. He will run at you, specifically at you, and in the distance of roughly 40 feet, 50 feet, I mean, he is traveling that distance in less than a second. So naturally, this is the phenomenon that's sending the majority of people out the door. We've had overnight groups stay as little as a half hour before they was just like, okay, we're done. But it's fascinating again, because we have, like it was the day after that paranormal lockdown episode aired, that little section of building or that hallway, got a lot of airtime that night. When Johnny Hauser was back there and they kind of left him by himself and he was getting pulled on and name being called out and everything. It was interesting. But the lady that called me the next day used to work here. She goes, you're never going to believe this. She said in room two, there was a gentleman that occupied that room who was 6'7". He was a nonverbal patient, mentally deranged, had killed a couple people in the past. This was a gentleman that you didn't even assist with a shoe change, you know, like you didn't even tie this gentleman's shoes for him, because he was actively going to try to hurt you. Now, he was also a gentleman that couldn't verbally express emotion, let alone process emotions like we can. So, I mean, he's just acting upon them as he sees fit. So in a way, I kind of feel sorry for this guy. But his claim to fame while here was whenever they were doing bed checks and rounds and all of that, he would come out of that room and just chase who was ever doing the documenting. I'm like, well, isn't that something? We're seeing very similar behaviors with this shadow man as this gentleman's behavior was in life. It's very interesting stuff to me. So again, like trying to correlate everything and see that to me, like that phenomenon to me, seems more like a residual type of haunt than anything else. We're seeing the exact same type of behavior over and over and over again. The problem is we can't pinpoint a time of day or night or time of year or week or anything. We cannot, there is no correlation at this point that we can see. So we're, again, we're always trying to figure this stuff out.
If you'd like to find out more about the Melvern Manor, you can visit their website, melvernmanor.weebly.com. That wraps up this episode of The Grave Talks. If you like this program, please press subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on. And please leave us a review and some stars. That helps other folks know that we exist. It helps us grow in the ratings and allows us to continue doing this program for you. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening, Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.